Before we go to John 4, would you turn with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 2? Everybody is drinking from some well. They might be looking for success or love or wealth or fame or something. But every person has this void. Everybody has an empty water pot that they're trying to fill. And with that, they're going to a number of different wells that this world has to offer. Solomon did it the best because as he was after this, in filling that void, he had the capacity, he had the finances, he had as ruler of all Israel and thus the ruler of the day, he had it all going for him. There was one man who could touch anything that he wanted and take it to be his. And still found nothing in the midst of that. And so I'd just like to, real quick, just run through Ecclesiastes 2. He starts off and said, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure, but surely this also was vanity. And he's going to explain it. I said of laughter, madness. And of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, how to lay hold on folly, until I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their life. I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. Made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers and delights of the sons of men and rock bands, musical instruments of all kinds. And so I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Listen to what verse 10 says. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. For my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my reward from all my labor. And then I looked on all the works that my hands had done and all the labor in which I had toiled. And indeed, he says, all was vanity. And grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. Wow. Here we have the wealthiest man able to have all of the wine, women, and song that life could offer. And he was able to grab onto with gusto every one of these things and found each one of them a dead end. He found each one of these water pots that he was drinking from to only come back to it even more thirsty for more in whatever category that he tried. Jesus offers another drink in John chapter 4, so we can start making our way over there. And when you drink from this drink, it's not only going to sustain you for time, but also for eternity. It's something that is so vital and so transforming and so satisfying with just one sip of faith, our deepest thirst is completely quenched. Let's read in chapter 4 and verse 1 through 15 what I've entitled Spiritual Dehydration. He says, therefore, when the Lord knew that the Pharisee had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, though Jesus himself did not baptize but his disciples, he left Judea and departed again to Galilee. But he needed to go through Samaria. So he came to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now, Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat thus by the well. It was about the sixth hour, so it's about noontime. Verse 7, a woman of Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, give me a drink. For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. Then the woman of Samaria said to him, how is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. Jesus answered and said to her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. The woman said to him, sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself as well as his sons and his livestock?" Jesus answered and said to her, "Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water, springing up into everlasting life." And the woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water that I may not thirst, nor come here to draw." Liquid water versus living water. Jesus, in the very first couple of verses, departs to avoid some popularity contest with John the Baptist's ministry and his disciples. He saw what the Pharisees were stirring up. Jesus had come down with his disciples and ended up, their ministry started growing. John's was shrinking because he said, "Behold the Lamb," and all of his disciples are starting to flock over towards Jesus's ministry now. And others are bringing that up. Now, John dealt with that. We talked about it a couple weeks ago. And John wasn't put out by it. He's the groom. I'm just the friend of the bridegroom. This is a good deal. This is a good thing. But they're still continuing to stir it up. And Jesus, in all of his awareness, he's going to get out of there. He didn't want it to become a popularity contest. And so he's going to leave. And so he's leaving the northern tip of the Dead Sea, where the Jordan River is, where they were baptizing. And he's going to head up to the Galilee region. Now, normally, Jews would go around the Jordan, come all the way up north. It takes twice as long, but to get up to Galilee, so they wouldn't have to go through that middle of Israel called Samaria, because they hated the Samaritans. But Jesus specifically has an appointment, this divine appointment that he's anticipating and waiting for. And so he cuts right through the Samaria area. And in verse 6, it says, being wearied from his journey. This is one of those places where, for instance, like the Jehovah's Witnesses and other religions that don't believe Jesus is God, these are the scriptures that they'll bring you to every time. See, he was thirsty. See, he was hungry. See, he was wearied. See, he was simply a man. You don't have to get excited about that. Simply nod your head and said, yes, that's what we're trying to say. He was simply a man. He was holy man, 100% man. But then we also have this other side, and he was 100% God. So we don't try to deny his humanity. There's very many places that talk about him. He was walking, it was a long way, middle of the noonday sun, hot day, I need to sit down and rest. He was a physical man. He became man. He truly became flesh. And so it's nothing to get excited about or worry about. We just simply need to show him the other scriptures that we've already been running across in John that shows Jesus is God also. But here in verse 7 is this unsuspecting appointment finally arrives at the Samaritan well. I understand it's about a half mile out of Sychar, out of town. We know where this well is today. And here is this thirsty, sun-parched woman carrying this water pot on her head. Women normally drew water at dawn and at dusk to be able to come at the cooler hours of the day. It was also a time of fellowship as they would visit, exchange news of what's going on your street and what's happening with so-and-so's household and just to be able to talk through all these different things. But here we are at noon, hottest time of the day. That's why Jesus is there. He's all alone, obviously. No one else is there. It wasn't a time that you normally went there, and there he sits and waits, and then here she comes out at the hottest time of the day. When the other women specifically wouldn't be there, which starts alluding to her reputation, which we'll read about in a little bit. Maybe braving this brazen sun to avoid the searing stares of the more reputable. So here she comes bearing an empty water pot. Maybe a kind of a telling symbol of the parched, barren heart. It's kind of spoke of that emptiness that was there on the inside that hasn't been revealed to her yet, but she's going to get it. And Jesus says, give me a drink. Here's the one who made Niagara thirsty. The one who shaped the Nile probably just took his fingernail in the sand to shape the Nile, saying, give me to drink. The one who could bring forth gallons of wine just a couple chapters earlier, now thirsty. She asked the question, how is it that a Jew talks to me? You know that most Jews look down on the Samaritans for a number of different reasons. One was ethically. They were half-breeds. All the way back to 720 BC when the Assyrians came down. The Assyrians, as we read about them in history, when they would come into a certain people group so as to water down their race, they would intermarry. And so they specifically take their people, plant them in that place, cause them to intermarry, interbreed, if you will, so as to weaken or water down their race. So So ultimately to, and they were able to do this in with a number of different people groups, that pretty soon that group is no longer a group as unto themselves. Why? So later on they can't raise up again and ever try to attack the Syrians. So that was just part of their format and part of what they did as their weapon of warfare. So with that, the true Jews saw the Samaritans, those who lived in the middle of Israel, half Jew, half Gentile, half breeds, we don't like you. That was one of the main problems that were there. There was no racial purity as they saw it. Second aspect, religiously, Jews looked down on them because they had what we call the Old Testament, all of the scriptures. But the those that worshiped there in Samaria, they only held to the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch or the ones that Moses wrote. That's all they held to. So the Jews looked down on that, saying, you're incomplete in as far as your religion goes. And of course, we'll see in a little bit, they believed in Mount Gerizim. They had a little temple there. Jews had it in Mount Zion or in Jerusalem, and that's where they went. Geographically, again, most Jews, as I said, would go completely out of their way, willing to travel on foot twice as far to not even step on their soil, but not Jesus. Samaria was part of his mission. Yeah, we have one of the places where he says, I come for the lost sheep of Israel. That was his main part of his ministry, but it didn't mean he didn't for so love the world that he came for the Samaritans and he came for the Gentiles and he came for all of them. Yeah, his ministry was geared towards the Jews most of the time, but we have a number of different cases where he's working with Gentiles and in this case, getting to lead her to Christ, lead her to himself. You know, Jesus in verse 10, if you knew the gift of God and who it was who says to you, see, he didn't really answer the question in 9. Why are you, a Jew, talking with me, a Samaritan? And Jesus doesn't always answer our questions, but he answers our needs. And he knew her need. And that was to give her living water. That's what she needed. And he's going to give her living water, and you'll see if you knew the gift of God and who. It comes down to that word know. If you just had relationship with, if you just knew, and we'll see that word used a little bit later on where she comes to that aspect of knowing. But he says in verse 11, in a true statement, sir, you don't have anything to draw with. When he's talking about giving her living water, it's like, it was a deep well. Matter of fact, today, this well still exists, as I said. And at this present time today, it's still 75 feet deep, which with all the debris and everything else over 2,000 years, it was a lot deeper than that then. And so she's looking around and saying, you don't have no 75-foot rope or plus, 100-foot rope and a bucket and any of that. How is this going to take place? She's trying to figure this out. As I say, this well still is around today, but unfortunately it's been glamorized and enshrined in marble, then a cave built around it, and then a Greek Orthodox church on top of that. But it is still there, and we do know something else from it. It actually has two aspects of supply that comes to this well. There's an underground source, and there's also the percolating water through the surface. Water comes into a cistern that way. So it's really fed by two different wells. Well, that'll make a little bit more sense later. When she's talking about the word well, and he uses fountain of living water, one is a running stream, one is a cistern that only holds a certain amount. And so it'll be kind of that play on words and using different words in the Greek. Verse 12, she says, are you greater than our father Jacob? This kind of a mild rebuff, mild rebuke against Jesus. Who do you think you are? Greater than Jacob who built this well? Kind of that's kind of where she's going. And you know what's the most awesome thing is Jesus is so gracious here. He is so patient in dealing with this woman. You realize when he deals with the Pharisees and the scribes and with them, he doesn't deal with that. As soon as he just shuts them down, walks away, doesn't answer their question, whatever else. But he sees and knows and perceives a heart that's just confused and wants to get it and just needs a little more info or whatever for the heart to be able to be touched. He'll spend all the time in the world. And there we have one of the most beautiful stories and all these verses given over to it just to show his patience. Imagine saying that to God. What do you think? You're greater than Jacob? A little bit. Yeah. Made Jacob, you know. Funny. Jesus patiently appeals to her immediate desire for physical water. We'll start there. But ultimately, I'm going to get you into the conversation to where something that is much more greater, less obvious to you, but much more greater, your spiritual thirst. So we'll talk about your physical thirst first, but ultimately that's where we're going to get to. Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again, Jesus says in verse 13. and how true that is. You're going after success, you'll thirst again. You get a little bit of wealth, you'll still thirst again. You go for fame, you're going to thirst again. Again, those are just a few of those countless springs that men continue to stoop and drink out of, but it doesn't help. Matter of fact, if I gave you a whole bunch of stickers that said, "Will thirst again," that's all it says on the sticker, "Will thirst again," you could just walk around today and just place it on all the different things in which it just doesn't satisfy. Walk up, slap one on your TV set, because you'll thirst again. You'll be there for the episode next week to see what happens. You'll thirst again on a bottle of booze, on a joint, whatever it is, on a prostitute, whatever it is. You can take these stickers on all these things in life because going to them, guaranteed, you will thirst again. What a great statement that he makes there, and so true. But even though I say that, and even though we really know that, it still seems that we still need to test the waters ourselves. We can't go back and read about Adam and Eve's life, how they tried the forbidden fruit that didn't satisfy them, and they thirsted again. But we don't learn from their story. We look back at Samson's life and he sees a woman in Timnah and says, "Ugh, dad, go get woman for me." And so he goes and gets her. That wasn't good enough. Then he goes down into what we know as the Gaza Strip and finds a Gaza Strip harlot, or a Gaza harlot on the strip, whatever. And then after that, she wasn't good. And then finds Delilah and ends up dying a thirsty man anyways. What about Solomon? Did his thirst ever get quenched with 700 wives and 300 concubines? It seems we still need to sample the waters ourselves, the world's waters, and going after them and sipping this and sipping that, gulping down this and gulping down that, and it doesn't satisfy, but we need to figure it out ourselves. But then he talks about in 14, this fountain of water springing up into everlasting life. Here is the love of God coming down like the Amazon River, rushing down to water one little flower, this precious, immoral woman of Samaria that he loves so incredibly. And so this fountain of living water to be able to touch this one life. Revelation 21:6, "I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts." What's the requirement? You just got to be spiritually thirsty, really wanting to understand who God is, really wanting to have a relationship with him, and not content to just going to church on Sunday, not content to just being I go to such and such church, be able to have a name tag that you can slap your name under or something like that. No, that's all I'm asking for is somebody who's actually thirsty. Sometimes people don't even realize that they're thirsty. Or again, thinking that they're going to be able to fill it with something else. But finally in 15, she says, "Sir, give me this water that I may not thirst nor come here to draw." Now she still doesn't get it. She's still thinking physical and not all the spiritual. But whatever he's talking about, she desires. And so it starts here. She wants it. She recognizes her thirst. But now sin must be dealt with. And so a radical change here. We went to commercial break and came back, it's just a completely different twist. Look at how Jesus handles it in 16 after she says, I'm thirsty. Give me this water. We needed to deal with something else first. Verse 16. Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come here." What? We're already talking about husbands. We're simply talking about thirst. I'm at a well. I got an empty pot. I'm thirsty. I want a drink. You're talking about water. And you tell me to go get my husband. Verse 17. The woman answered and said, "I have no husband." And Jesus said to her, "You have well said, I have no husband. For you've had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband. In that you spoke truly." The guy you're with now, you're shacking up with. That's what he's saying. You know, before the cleansing water must come the confessing daughter. That's where he's bringing her to. No conversion without this aspect of conviction. And so now her appetite is watered. But we need to deal with this sin issue. I think Jesus was realizing this is a dead-end path. As you've been talking with somebody and you're realizing, okay, this isn't going anywhere. And we're going to change and we're going to talk about this over here. Because we're going to get you to the foot of the cross. That's where we need to get him. And that's what happens here. And so what he's going to do is all of a sudden shift and say, let's deal with your personal life for a second. Now, I don't know about you, but I remember especially when I first started talking with my dad years ago. We could talk about anything in church. And again, he's kind of business-minded, businessman. And so he saw, you know, Brian, big church, successful. And that's kind of how dad related to it. How's the church? But that's what he meant by it. Is it growing? And is it successful? And that's kind of the questions. And so I would answer those questions and then get around and say, but dad, what about you? And I've had him spring. I didn't know my dad could move so fast. I'd see him leap out of the, I got to get in the backyard, you know, and go flying out the door. I'd be chasing him, you know, that kind of thing. Where all of a sudden he was good talking about church general, but to take it personal now, he was out of the chair. Now, the end of life is much different, and I was able to talk with him, and we talked about spiritual things every time that I met with him after that. But in those beginning times, boy, it was just like, whoa! And you've probably experienced that too, where all of a sudden the conversation, as soon as you turn it to go personal, and they go, whoo, and that's what's happening here. It's like Jesus says, hold on just a second, and he takes a full-length mirror and slides it in front of her, and she's going, whoa! Having to deal with her personal life. It's that sobering reflection when you wake up in the morning and first look in the mirror. Whoa, that kind of same thing. Except spiritually, she was kind of doing this. Whoa, the sober reflection here of what's taking place. Kind of flushing with an embarrassment, wanting to kind of tilt the mirror another way. And he's kind of just tipping it back again. No, we need to look at this head on. We all know the story of the Good Samaritan. Some call this the story of the Bad Samaritan as we're kind of hearing about her life and what she's going through. Let's just pause and stop for a second and talk about living together. And is that right, you know, prior to marriage? Does living together constitute marriage? No matter how long you do it, does it? There seems to be a difference here. Jesus specifically is saying, no, you were married 5 times, but now you're not. The guy you're with now, no, I don't consider it marriage. But it's very interesting because the folks that I talk to say that, well, we love each other. And it feels right, and we've committed ourselves to each other, and we're married in the eyes of God. No, right here, no, it's not. Now, if you're in that situation, don't go running away. We'd love to sit down and talk with you. And we'd love to talk you through this and what God expects. Now, let's set the Bible just over there just for a second and say, just statistically, just look at the statistics of people that live together and sleep together before they get married. It's in the low 80 percentile. It's like 82 to 84% of people that live together first, kind of try each other out, see if it's going to work kind of thing, end up getting divorced. I think it's within 2 to 3 years. That is a huge mark against individuals that are going that route. It's not a good practical way to do. Go. Bible back. Okay, but then this aspect here, he's going, no, I don't see it that. You're not married in my eyes. So don't say that. That's not true. Again, as I always use the analogy of fire, is fire good or bad? Again, fire contained is a good thing. In your fireplace, on your stove, that's a good thing. Sex is the same way. Contained within a marriage unit, that's a good thing. Outside of a marriage unit, that's a bad thing. It's a wildfire. And it's going to burn up homes and damage and hurt individuals and hurt people emotionally and a number of other things that go along with that. But not married in their sight, no. But here's what you do. You allow God to expose you and cleanse you. I've sat down with a number of couples, as with our other pastors, and saying, here's our situation. We're living together. There's no way we can separate now. And we can barely afford the apartment, let alone these two things. But it's been a blast for anyone that I believe has said, we want to do the right thing. We've been able to help them out. Finding the, you know, okay, you're the dude, you get out, let her stay in the place. And is her mom, is her dad, is her brothers, is her sisters? If not, somebody at the church. I know somebody. We'll plug you in as we go through pre-marriage counseling and let's do this thing the right way. Let's start it off fresh. But all I'm saying is we'd love that opportunity to be able to sit down and because you're probably saying, I just don't know how it would work. We would just simply like to sit down and say how. Because we want the best for you and the best for your life. And of course, God to be able to be honored in the midst of that. And so come talk to us if that's kind of your situation there. Well, let's move on to verse 19. And she's, now I call her the clever Samaritan. The woman said to him, sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. You know, because he just kind of read her life. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming and now is when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. Or we can say it this way. in spirit and in sincerity. For the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. The woman said to him, I know that the Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things. And Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. Or I who speak to you am. I am. So clear, so direct. Christ's sharp perception here is what kind of pricks her conscience, and she starts squirming and shifting to a more comfortable conversation. She goes to the let's argue religion technique. You've experienced this also. I've been talking to Jehovah's Witness friends, and all of a sudden, what church do you go to anyways? I never answer them. I never tell them my pastor. Well, I usually don't tell them pastor, and I don't tell them what church, because they'll find something wrong with our church or something like this. It's a right-hand turn. And so I give as less information as I can. I usually don't even tell them that I'm a Christian. I'm just, they get that in the midst of talking with them. But let's just deal with the subject at hand. It doesn't matter what church I go to. Let's deal with what the Word of God says. But anything to argue religion. What about the heathen in Africa? What about them pygmies in pygmy land? What about the whole aspect? How can a good God allow suffering and evil? And what about creation and evolution? And is it sprinkling or is it immersion? And is it real wine or is it grape juice? Is it King James or Living Bible? Is it, you know, whatever it is? The conversation gets turned to all these different things. And you and I like fighting about them, so we end up biting. Oh, yeah, well, it is King J, you know, whatever it is. And we get off on our little tangent, and we make the minors majors. But this is her little red herring here. She hopes that will hide her blemished soul from his penetrating gaze. And so she drags the smoked herring across her trail to cover up her scent, just as they used to do in England to throw off the tracking dogs from the fox. That's where that word red herring comes, you know, throw out a herring and red herring in that way, is just to throw the off track. But this vixen won't get away from this terrific tracker. He's on her toes. He's on her heels. He's following her in each and every turn of the way. And you want to talk about spiritual things? You want to talk about where did this? Okay, this is good. This is a good subject. And so he's able, though she makes it a distraction, he brings it right back to the aspect, or is going to get her back to that same place of worship. We're talking true worship, real worship, not ritual worship, real worship. Let's talk about real worship. Because what you're talking about is this mountain or that mountain, and that's ritual worship that you're talking about. Here we get to see the intent of Jesus' ministry to get somebody to a realization of the state of their life, ultimately then to a place of repentance, ultimately then to the place of new life, and then after that, what is true worship? Can I read from in verse 23? This is out of the Message Bible. I know some people don't like sections of the Message Bible, but this verse is great here. Listen to what it says. But the time is coming, it has in fact come, when what you're called will not matter, and where you go to worship will not matter. It's who you are and the way you live that counts before God. Your worship must engage your spirit in the pursuit of truth. That's the kind of people the Father is out looking for. Those who are simply and honestly themselves before him in their worship. That's honest worship. That's that true worship. Sincere worship is not being a phony. Sincere worship is truly meaning it from your heart. Not, well, I guess it's Sunday morning, I guess I'll go to church kind of thing. But it's the aspect of God, I seek to connect with you. I seek to truly come to give of my time, talents, and treasures. It's truly laying your heart on the line saying, God, you're real and I love you radically and here I am before you. Knowing him personally in that way. So he says, it's not the location of worship, it's the object of worship. It's not where you worship, but how you worship. And not only how you worship, but ultimately who you worship. That's what it's all about. Verse 23 answers the question of why we do missions and why we should share our faith and evangelize, as we call it. Because the Father is seeking such to worship him. That is the ultimate reason why Jesus is doing it here for the Father's sake. See, we always think of sharing for someone so they don't spend their eternity in hell. Now, that's a good and a proper reasoning, but I would call it second, okay? because of what we learned in last chapter, for God, the Father, so loved the world that he sent his son Jesus, right? For God so loved the world. Here's what he's after. The Father is seeking such to worship him. Let's give the Father what he desires. So when we go out and do missions, when we share with somebody, it's an offering unto the Lord and we're giving him what he desires. That should be first and foremost to glorify God in our missions and in evangelism. That's what it's about. Now, the byproduct of that is saving a soul from hell. That's good. And there's probably a ton of things behind that. But first and foremost, it's for the Father. Everything comes back to him and should and why we do what we do. And so this aspect of sincere and spiritual worship, how can we break that down or define that out? Well, it's a submission of all of our nature to God. It's the quickening of our conscience by his holiness. It's the nourishment of mind with his truth. It's the purifying of imagination by his beauty. It's the opening of our heart to his love and the surrender of will to his purpose. You don't need to find God in a special place. True worship finds him in every place. You know, it's a weird thing for me. When I got saved in 1980, all I knew was a Catholic church. And so coming into a Protestant church, it's like, they don't even have an altar. What's up with this? It's like a stage. It's like a band stage. What's up with that? But it was this mentality in the Roman Catholic Church, which goes back to the Old Testament with the tabernacle and the temple. Why were those places more important than they are today? They were important at a time. Why? Because God dwelt there. And so within a Catholic church, rightly so, with their understanding of it, they have a tabernacle up on the altar. Some of the new ones have it right behind the altar. But the bottom line is they believe the Eucharist, when the priest prays over them, the Eucharist actually becomes, in the wine, becomes the body and blood of Christ. And so God then is in that tabernacle, which makes the altar a holy place, which makes the church or cathedral a holy place. And that's why it is so important of the place of the altar. That's why within Protestant churches, it's not an altar. It's a place where I stand and speak from. It's kind of a little bit of elevated so I can see all of your eyes and all of that. It's where our worship team is. But we're not trying to say this right here or back there on the drums or wherever else up here that this is more holier than out there or out in our parking lot or in your home or in your garage. There isn't a place anymore, and it was all dealt with right here. It isn't because God's in that place. Matter of fact, Jesus himself said, you know, it's better that I go. And what he meant by that, as he's talking to his disciples, is because I can only be physically in one place at one time as long as I'm in this physical body here. But if I go to you, I send another unto you, the Holy Spirit, because what was going to happen? He's now going to indwell every believer, and now he can be anywhere, everywhere, in all of our lives and wherever we go. Church is where you go. It's as you come here, church. As you go down to the, you know, get some plumbing supplies, church. It's where you go because you're a spiritual entity and God is dwelling inside of you. You are that tabernacle. You are that temple. You don't need to find God in a special place. True worship finds him in every place. So it's not a certain place. It's not a certain time of the week. It's not a certain format. True worship then is relationship. And that's what happens in 25 and in 26. Hey, you know what? When Messiah comes, he's going to say this, and he says, standing right in front of you. Rarely, 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 rarely does he ever do this. That clear, it's usually in a parable, a little bit covered. Who do you think I am? Asking the different things, but here he says, I am he. It's beautiful what takes place as this develops in starting back in verse 9. When she first met Jesus, what are you, a Jew, talking to me, a Samaritan, calls him a Jew. In verse 11, sir, calls him sir. 12, are you greater than our father Jacob? So her interest is piqued. Down to verse 19, whoa, I think you're a prophet. And now here in verse 25, talks about Messiah. Down to verse 29, we haven't read yet. She goes back to her city and tells a bunch of guys and says, I think I found the Christ. So you see that beautiful development, a Jew, sir, maybe greater than Jacob, a prophet, Messiah, the Christ. She's pretty ignited here in verse 26. Hearing this, he's displayed this, And at this dramatic cliffhanging moment, then 27 takes place. And at this point, his disciples came and they marveled that he talked with a woman. Yet no one said, "What do you seek?" or "Why are you talking with her?" The woman then left her water pot, went her way into the city, and said to the man, "Come, see a man who told me all things that I ever did. Could this be the Christ?" And they went out of the city and came to him. That's where we're going to end this morning, right there. And I'll just share just a couple last things. Right in the most unopportune time, disciples come back. "Got the burger and fries. Hey, what's he doing talking to this lady? What's going on?" They're not going to say anything, but they all feel it. It's very uncomfortable for them. It's uncomfortable for her, not Jesus, but for everybody else that's included in this. It's just kind of like, okay, I'm going to be going now. And she takes off, leaves her water pot and just takes off. And he's going to get into them about talking about lunch next, and we'll pick up on that next Sunday. But let's leave off with verse 28. The woman left her water pot. Wait a minute, that's what she came for. Wait a minute, that's what was most important to her in the very hot of the day, to be able to bring this empty water pot and get it filled with water. But now all of a sudden something is filled in her heart. Went to fill the water pot, but now her heart now came back full of this living water. And I guess what's the most amazing thing is he can do that in your life too. You're after something, you're walking around with your empty water pot, and you're trying to fill it with something. You know it needs to be filled with something, you just don't know what. And this morning's revealing to you, saying, here's what it is. And you know what? No matter how stagnant your water is or how empty your pot is, all it takes is one sip of faith to be spiritually hydrated. That's what he's saying. Just one sip of faith to be spiritually hydrated this morning. We saw him free. He freed a woman from habitual immorality. He freed worship from a limitation of this little place right here. He desires to free you today from a dehydrated, parched, barren, sin-filled life. And it's yours for the asking. He said back in verse 10, if you knew the gift of God and who it is, and in verse 26, she knew. That's when she got her answer. And maybe this morning, you're getting your answer. Maybe this morning you can say, okay, now I know. Now I see what I've been going after and finding that it's futile. Maybe you're going to believe what Solomon said, richest guy in the world, back in Ecclesiastes 2, and realizing that all these other ends are dead ends. They're dry wells in the end. And maybe you'll receive exactly what she did, and you're willing to come. Whoever's thirsty, to come and drink. You'll have eternal life. That's what he offers you this morning. Let's pray.